In his 80th floor office, Kilov was wasting no time.
I want an advanced reconnaissance plane. 2 drones to advance to these coordinates. G5-T2 on western sector grid map. Transmit only in code. I want them off the ground in 3 minutes. Yablonsky, I don't want army or regular air force in on this.
Of course, Your Excellency.
We will use 2 of the neutron bombs I have stored away just for this eventuality.
Vice General Straxen, from a group of 20 assembled officers, spoke up.
But, sir, Premier Vasily has given direct orders to our military personnel not to use...
You dare tell me what to do?
No, not at all, sir.
The Premier doesn't want us to go out hunting with atomic bombs, not go setting them off like madmen. But now we know where these rebels are. This is a surgical operation. Clean, instantaneous. Believe me, my unthinking comrade. When the Premier sees what we have done, he will give us medals.
Yes, of course. I didn't understand.
Kilov made a mental note to get rid of the idiot as quick as possible. The man was probably a plant of Zhabnov's or the Premier's.
Now, Yablonsky, I want you personally to pilot the bomber that takes these in. You've had experience with this sort of thing. This mission can't fail. You know what's at stake, and you're the only man I trust to carry it out flawlessly.
Kilov looked at the young rising star of the KGB. If he handled this one right, big things were in store for all of them.
I shall not fail you, leader.
Yablonsky, commander of the KGB Air Force, saluted and walked out of the door, heading for the airstrip a quarter mile away. Kilov knew he would not fail. The day began beautifully in Westfort. The Green Valley was flooded with the clearest sunlight the free Americans had seen in years. The sun's rays trickled down through the green and red and golden leaves, creating patterns of dappled light along the dirt roads and onto the hides of the animals protesting at pulling their loads. The people of Westfort were in a good mood this morning. Without the scientists at the disposal of Century City and some of the other more developed and technologically advanced free cities, and without the equipment or supplies, the city had over the years developed a laid-back, Western style of living, of easygoingness. Farmers, small craftsmen, hunters, the city of about 5,000 traded with one another and with neighboring towns to meet their subsistence needs. They lived in wooden cabins, 50 or 60 feet apart, and shared communal bathing facilities. There was a sense of camaraderie, of sharing in Westfort that was worth all the gold or electrical generating equipment in the world. Many of the free cities that now lived a secret life hidden from the eyes of their Russian enslavers had sprung up just out of nowhere. 2 families, the Capstons and the Maldonados, fleeing from the storm of atomic bombs that fell that fateful day, a century earlier, had traveled for weeks in the woods and then come upon these valleys at the foot of some low mountains. They had stopped to camp for the night or two to catch their breath and had never left. Westfort was populated with their descendants and a few lost stragglers who had wandered in from time to time. The citizens of Westfort set about their daily tasks, working the fields hidden by ingenious brown netting that let light through but created the illusion of being solid ground to any passing video drones or choppers. In one of the vegetable fields, little Jamie Curtis was playing behind her father's mules as they pulled a large, double-sided plow that swept the dark earth into 2 mounts on each side of the blade.
Watch out, Jamie. Come on now, you get away from there. You could get hurt.
Oh, Daddy, I'll be fine.
The little girl continued playing in the spray of dirt that flew up behind the beasts of burden. Her blonde pigtails tossed in the early morning breeze as she jumped and frolicked in her denim coveralls. Pete stopped and looked at his daughter jumping.
Get on there, you damn mules. Oh, you won't move? Here, why don't... Hey, what's that sound?
Everyone in Westfort heard the sound at the same moment. The city was only 2 miles from one end to the other. You could almost yell to someone on the opposite side.
It's a plane.
They were well hidden, but Pete was still worried. The plane roared in until it was directly overhead, 4,000 feet up. Through the air holes of the netting, the spaces between the trees, the townspeople stared up apprehensively. 2 small, glinting objects detached themselves from the jet, which immediately wheeled sharply to the left and accelerated its departure in a trail of blue exhaust. The people watched curiously as 2 parachutes opened over the falling objects and slowed them to a crawl as they dropped directly toward the center of the valley.
What is it, Daddy?
Riley, no, baby. Maybe some kind of leaflet or propaganda or something. They do that sometimes, drop posters all around, try to scare us into surrendering.
Don't surrender, Daddy!
Oh, you don't have to worry about that.
The parachutes dropped lower and lower, hovering right over the center of town. Every eye watched. Every heart slowed to a crawl.
Wait, is that...
It was a blast so hot that it burned every eyeball, instantly fusing it to its socket, turning the faces of the watchers into a black leathery substance in less than a millionth of a second. They didn't even have time to scream, as the heat and gamma rays of a million-degree thermonuclear neutron bomb shot through their living cells. They crumpled to the ground, their cellular structures broken down into a mass of putty and charred carbon. Brains oozed out of black eye holes and wide-open powdery mouths. Fingers slid off of hands, and feet dropped from legs as the tissue, the muscles, and the tendons dissolved and fell into boiling puddles to the burning ground. Every living thing in Westfort, every man and woman and child, every dog and sheep and cow, every bird, every plant and tree and blade of grass was instantly and totally annihilated. The smoke of the two blasts formed into one violently churning mushroom cloud, glowing orange and yellow and black, that quickly stretched up nearly 2,000 feet in the air. But with the western wind strong this morning, that soon blew away. Now the town looked positively peaceful. The houses mostly intact, coffee cups standing where they had been set, a canoe drifting silently in a still pond. Only the shriveled bodies, as black as meat cooked for days in a blast furnace, and the stripped and smoldering trees betrayed the fact that anybody had lived there in the past 100 years. Century City's main underground thoroughfare was bustling with people and activity as Roxon left the council chambers and walked slowly through the center of the Lincoln Square, nearly 2,000 feet square and 100 high. Here, the main industrial and assembly work of the Free Fighters went on, with large ventilation fans in the raw rock ceiling pulling out smoke and chemical fumes. It had been nearly a month since Roxon had time enough to slow down and see how things were going. An elderly, white-bearded gent walked up to him, pushing a dolly loaded higher than he was with chemicals for the hydroponics.
Hey, howdy, Rock!
Hey, Keaton. We'll have to hit the plains again. Teach me a bit more about tracking.
Goddamn right!
Roxon moved on, exchanging greetings with scores of Century City citizens who stopped to talk and press the flesh of their war champion. The jobs of Century City were divided up by a complex process of lottery and skills. Those who were highly trained in such work as computer chip assembly, weapon making, and hydroponics worked continuously at these jobs, but even they were expected to put in their share of free time working on the ever-expanding tunnel network of Century City, which had to be continually added to accommodate the city's growing population, storage, and industrial needs. Other workers were chosen by rotating lottery to work at the hard labor, changed every few months so that all citizens shared equally in the hardest and least favored jobs, such as sewer maintenance, transporting goods, and regular maintenance of the camouflage to protect the city. The most prestigious job of Century City, and the one that all citizens had their names on waiting lists for the apprenticeships to open up, was the building of the Liberator Automatic Rifle. The rifle, Century City's main export to other free cities for use in the war against the Reds, was the pride of every man and woman of the town. Invented by Dr. Schechter, it was a 9mm rifle that could, with a snap of a switch, change from single shot to full auto, with a muzzle velocity of 1,200 meters per second, firing 50 round clips. The non-jamming rifle came with silencer and infrared night scope. As the Reds had found out, the rifle could rip a man's chest apart at half a mile. The Liberator was one of the Free Fighters' most potent weapons against the Red Invaders, and it was much in demand in the other hidden cities who traded back their own small-scale industrial goods, pelts, or produce as payment. The Liberator was produced in a large factory assembly line layout at the northern section of the cavernous industrial square. Work went on 24 hours a day in three shifts of 200 workers each. The need for such weapons was too great and too important to ever stop. Over 400 of the weapons were produced a day, then shipped out in small 10-man groups on mule and hybrid. It was Dr. Schechter's dream, and Rock's, that within the next 10 years, assembly lines for the rifle and ammunition could be built in all the Free Cities. Roxon took the elevator 4 levels down to hydroponics to see how things were going. He walked through a sliding steel door and held his palm up to a sensor set in the solid rock wall. Roxon walked into a well-lit agricultural paradise, nearly a quarter of a mile long. An entire level had been devoted to farming and experimental crossbreeding. Within temperature-controlled walls, the biologists who worked these sections had stored and cataloged nearly half of every variety of plant and vegetable from pre-war America. They were ecstatic when a member of the community, hunting expedition, or attack group came back with new varieties of flora. Someday, every one of these seeds would be the beginning of millions, billions of plants that would cover the decimated continent once again when it was free.
Hello, Roxon. Good to see you back safe from another expedition.
Good for us, not the Russians, Dr. Kraft.
Oh, of course.
The overweight, constantly fidgeting Kraft was one of the miracle workers, along with Dr. Schechter, of Century City. Kraft seemed able to do absolutely anything with seeds. He had crossbred countless forms of vegetation, making them useful again.
How are the plants? There was some sort of fungus attacking everything just before I left.
Oh, they're fine. You know, actually, that was quite an interesting case. We were losing about a 20th of the wheat and barley crops a day, and we're looking for vegetation fungus, bacteria, as the culprit. Turns out it was a mutated form of hoof and mouth disease. We treated it with the drug that had been prescribed 100 years ago, and presto! Yeah, no more damaged crops. We are working on breeding a resistance into all the grain products now, so there won't be any more such outbreaks.
He and Roxon walked among the acres of plant life. The hydroponic gardens consisted of long metal troughs nearly 50 feet in length and 3 feet wide, filled with a liquid chemical solution. The plants were grown, floating in the mixture, in row after row, with specially designed ultraviolet heat lamps shining down from above, placed about 5 feet apart. The entire operation consisted of over 20 acres of vegetation, using every available inch in the chambers, with rows of plants on top of one another. The gardens easily fed the populace their foodstuff needs, but that was only half the hydroponics' goal.
Kraft, you might want to take a look at this.
What is it?
On the way back, we found this weird luminous pond that consisted of thousands of these things. I found one off to the side and thought you might want to take a look.
2 inches long, seahorse-shaped. Rock, this could well be a successful new form of life. We've heard stories of things like this in from all over the country, but we rarely get to actually examine them.
This is successful?
Well, you have to understand, Rock. Successful is kind of a subjective word. In this radioactive climate, DNA is scrambled much more frequently in utero than before. Most of these scramblings result in the zygotes dying before or right after term, but once in a great while they survive with small changes like the dogs you encountered.
You heard about that?
Word travels fast in Century City. But anyway, freak mutations such as this can happen once in a great while. Its success is simply it becoming better adapted to its environment. And it's been happening much faster than in the past. The world will be populated by a vastly different group of creatures over the next few centuries. It could well be that this is one of them. You said there were thousands?
Yeah, and they all pulsed as if they were one. Weird, huh?
Quite. A symbiotic life support colony is very rare. Bees, of course, and ants. Oh, I do wish we had a live specimen to work with.
Yeah, I'll be sure to snatch one up the next time I walk by.
That would be great, yeah.
He left the scientist to play with his newest exotica and headed out of the subterranean gardens, moving into the series of interconnecting tunnels that led to the large gymnasium of Century City, built in the last 10 years. If there was any spot on Earth that truly made him feel at home, it was in the Century City Gymnasium, where he had spent years working his body and reflexes until they were razor sharp. He felt a warm feeling in his gut as he held his hand up to the sensor on the stone wall at the end of a long, dimly lit corridor. The large chamber was quite beautiful, with muted light coming from overhanging rocks, giving the illusion of being outdoors, and palm trees ringing the sides. It was a large, circular space, almost 200 feet in diameter and 50 feet high, chopped out of the solid rock of the mountain. The gymnasium was fully equipped with squash courts, a swimming pool, weightlifting and gymnastics equipment, and two large mats for sparring and martial arts. Rock couldn't help but chuckle as he sauntered over to the biggest of the thick tatami mats and saw Rona Walenda and Al Chen engaged in an energetic testing of skills. Rona was probably the toughest woman in Century City and was also in love with Rock, which he pretended to ignore. She was a gymnast, acrobat, and fighter, a great-great-granddaughter of the famous Walendas of pre-war days, who had been world-famous for their expertise in tightrope walking. But skilled as Rona was in karate and jujitsu, and there was many a man, friend, or foe she could best within seconds, she was no match for the martial arts chief instructor of Century City, Al Chen. Rock watched from behind a pillar, unnoticed, as the two circled each other slowly, carefully placing one foot down, letting the weight drop fully, then slowly shifting the other foot. They moved like cats. Their hands were held out in front of them, prepared to attack or parry. Rona held her hands straight out, the fingers curled back in tight, hard fists. Chen's hands were more relaxed, as was his whole fighting style, fluid and loose. Chen wore an amused smile beneath the thin black mustache which covered his upper lip and hung down the sides of his mouth, Fu Manchu style. Rona lunged suddenly, followed by a roundhouse kick to the head of Chen. But where she struck, there was only air. The master of five of the fighting arts, Sing Yi, Go Ju, Tai Chi, Aikido, and Wing Chun, was quicker than the wind. Rona didn't stand a chance. Rona was tall, 5'10", beautiful, and right now a sweaty heap on the floor. A striking figure with her brilliant red hair and her full-bodied voluptuous figure. Half the men in Century City would have given a month's R&R to sleep with her, but she only wanted Ted Roxon. Rona rose from the mat, brushing back her flowing hair which momentarily covered her alabaster complexion face. She moved forward again.
Good kick, but you're too angry, my sweet warrior. When force meets force, the stronger force wins. The purpose of martial arts is to use the stronger force against itself. If I were to let you hit me with one of your blows, I'd probably be knocked out. But I don't, you see. You could be one of the best, Rona, but you still have too much anger at the world. Maybe at men?
Ah, come on, Rona. You can get him.
Rock!
Hey, Rock. Well, good to see you. It's been months since we worked together.
As Chen turned to greet Roxon, Rona saw her opportunity. She leapt at the slim but well-muscled Chinese fighter, but he was too fast for her. He sidestepped, grabbed her leg and pushed her along, right into the deep end of the pool.
Bastard! Oh!
Come on now, Rona. That's not the sporting way. If you were just a touch more relaxed about it all, you'd be a 100 times better fighter.
Oh, you too, Roxon. Sometimes you men make me so mad, just trying to show me up.
And get you into the pool.
I'd like to see you try. Try me, that is.
I'd love to take you up on that offer, Rona.
Rock's mouth twisted up at the right-hand corner, a gesture which Rona found fascinating. There was so much about this man that she loved, was drawn to. If only he would give himself to her the way she wanted to give herself to him.
But first, Al and I need a good workout. If I'm gonna keep my reflexes sharp, I've gotta work with the best. And Al is the best.
Roxon took off his white civilian shirt and took off his rubber-padded indoor shoes. Stepping on the mat, he bowed to Chen. Chen bowed back.
I'm flattered, my friend. But as to who is the best, only the gods know that.
The two men began slowly, circling each other like two jungle cats, graceful, fluid, their motions a perfect mirror for one another. Rona watched in fascination. Chen, in his kung fu shoes and black, loose-fitting ninja sparring suit, was a good 6 inches shorter than the muscular 6'3 Roxon, whose deeply tanned chest and arms bulged with the steel muscles of a lifetime of sweat and survival. They circled for almost 30 seconds, watching for a moment's advantage. Each was wary. Chen crouched low in his scissor leg stance, the knees close together, the feet kicking out like levers at every step. Roxanne just circled. He had studied countless systems, read books on all the fighting styles, but mostly he had experienced it. Chen suddenly sprang and released a windmill of punches. Rock went with a lightning-fast scissor kick, rolling to the mat and rising again, all in one smooth motion.
Is a catch.
Catch this.
Rock fell backwards to the mat as he kicked Chen's stomach, so that his motion pulled Chen, still holding the ankle, forward and over his head. They both rolled and came off facing one another. Chen smiled.
Excellent, Rock. You're getting better all the time.
Thanks for the kudos, but I'm not really hurting you.
Nor am I. Mexican standoff.
They continued for a good 10 minutes. Neither was really able to get the upper hand. An occasional punch or kick would slide through the other's defense, but their reflexes and speed were so quick that they would merely twist their bodies to go with a blow and take any sting out of it. They had both built up quite a sweat, drops of salty spray flying from their whipping hands and legs. Suddenly, Chen stopped.
I think we are both at that stage of martial arts development, where there is such an equalness of skill that it is like fighting one's own self. We know what the other is thinking, even as he strikes. As my own master Lu once said to me, when you meet a man you cannot best, nor can he best you, that man is your brother in the spirit of Qi. Rock, you and I have reached that harmony. You, Ted Roxon, are my brother in the Qi life force.
He bowed deeply forward, his hands clenched in fists.
But I'm beginning to feel tired. And I do have a training class coming up in 20 minutes, and I must do my Qigong meditation before training. So, if you will excuse me, my friend.
Chen walked off to the showers and then to his private meditation chamber, bare, covered in white cloth with only a single silk pillow for sitting in the center. Roxon walked over to Rona, who lay sprawled on her back, relaxing in the center of the second tatami mat.
You're something else, Rock. Anyone else in Century City would be out cold in about 2 seconds with Master Chen. Yet you stand your ground.
He's a better fighter than I am, Rona. He just holds back with me so that the sparring can give him a workout.
Bull. If anything, you could beat him. Or at least it would be a hell of a fight.
I'll never fight him. I fight only my enemies to kill. The fighting that Chen and I do is fighting of friends, of teaching one another.
Oh, I know. No need to be so heavy-handed philosophical all the time.
She put her hand around his taut, muscled thigh.
I've missed you a lot, Rock.
She pulled him on top of her, kissing him full on the lips, crushing her body against his with all of her strength. They embraced for several minutes, hands stroking warm flesh. Then Rock lifted her off of him and silently jumped to his feet. Taking her by the hand, he led her to one of the massage rooms at the far end of the gymnasium and locked the door behind him. Soon they were locked in the oldest embrace of man and woman, and the most pleasurable.